The next matter on the agenda is Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on Chris Dodd for President. Good morning. Mr. Smith or Mr. Bonowitz, you have a presentation? Mr. Smith?
Sure.
Great.
Good morning, Commissioners. Presented before you is the Audit Division Recommendation Memorandum on Chris Dodd for President. It outlines our recommendations to the Commission for the proposed final audit report. The Audit Division is prepared to address...
Mr. Smith, could you move the microphone a little bit closer? Thank you.
Sure. Can you hear me better now? You want me to start over?
No.
Okay. The Audit Division is prepared to address any questions or concerns you may have.
Any comments, questions, concerns? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I've been trying to get my mind around the bus. Trying to wrap my mind around the wrapped bus. Can you explain to me why you think the the amount of the prohibited contribution is the entire amount of the bus rental and that it isn't prorated, although I think we understand that the union or its PAC used the bus for part of the time. So why do we think the Dodd Committee ultimately did pay, and I think actually it ought to be acknowledged that while they paid untimely, they kind of overpaid to try and put this issue behind them and to try and address the whole bus issue. But the fact that they may have overpaid, I think, does not necessarily mean that the whole thing was a prohibited contribution. So why isn't the rental cost prorated?
The audit staff maintains that the amount of the prohibited contribution is $15,000, because at the time the RV rental costs were incurred, the IAF paid for the rental costs on behalf of the committee.
How do we know that? Didn't they use it first on their own?
We believe there may have been some use by the committee on their own.
So then why do we think they did it entirely on behalf of the Dodd Committee?
They made the payment for the rental, that's why.
Who made the
committee
payment?
Paid for the rental of the RV.
Right, but so we're getting a little, which committee? Fire PAC or the Dodd Committee?
IAFF paid for the rental of the RV.
Okay, and why do you think that that is evidence that they did it on behalf of the Dodd Committee? Because you just told me that mm-hmm. they used it themselves for at least a portion of the time.
Well, because eventually the Dodd Committee repaid for the entire amount.
Well, I know they did, but my understanding, based on, you know, and the hearing was a long time ago, sadly, but my understanding of what happened was that they didn't have the money to pay for it when they should have paid for it at the beginning, when it first happened. They ultimately, when they did have the money, they tried to make it right by paying for the whole thing. They said, we're not going to get into, you know, trying to nitpick over how many days we used it versus how many days you used it. We're just going to pay for the whole thing. But that, the fact that they did that, I think should be acknowledged by us, but not necessarily as an admission in any way that was, you know, the entire cost of it was on their behalf. I think they were just trying to get themselves out of a jam that they had gotten into because they didn't have money at the outset.
Well,
I'm happy to hear from anybody on this.
In addition to paying the full amount, both the committee and the IAF Fire Pack reported the full amount of the bus cost, including both the wrapping and the rental. For over a year, they reported it as a debt owed, and then they finally paid it and reported it as a debt paid. So even though the initial invoice asked for less based on a pro rata, the subsequent evidence was that they considered the full amount to be the amount that they owed and the amount that they paid.
But what they can, does the legal conclusion necessarily follow from what they thought? You know, isn't that our job to figure out as a legal matter what was the amount of the contribution? And the thing I keep coming back to is that if they used it on their own for a while, why is the amount of time that IAFF or FirePAC was using the bus, why is that considered a contribution to the Dodd campaign?
Well, we were basing it on the evidence that we had, which is the reports of what was owed. And the check that they gave us, the copy of the check that they gave us, it showed that they paid that amount. So that appeared to indicate that the parties agreed that they owed the full $32,000 for both the wrapping and the rental. That's all the auditors can do is look at the evidence that they have, and that was the evidence that they had.
Yeah, looking at the evidence, because they paid them the full amount and carried the debt, we presume that they paid it on behalf of Dodd.
Well, it seems to me the evidence is at best conflicting, because we've also got an invoice that's for less than the full amount. So why isn't that evidence?
Well, because subsequent to that, and the committee did say in abundance of caution, they paid the entire amount, but because they paid the entire amount, we presume that that's the full amount of the contribution would be the $15,000.
Well, they paid $32,000. We're not.
That was for the wrapping and
right.
Et cetera.
But we're not. So we're not taking the fact that they paid the $32,000 as evidence that there was a $32,000 prohibited contribution. Why are we taking the same fact and saying, but that means that you take out the wrapping cost and the full amount of the bus rental? It seems to me that it's inconsistent.
Well, I think, too, there were some earlier discussions about the entire cost, and it was decided that we weren't going to pursue the wrapping cost, we were just going to pursue the rental, so that's why we're just pursuing the entire rental cost instead of the
$32,000. Commissioner McGinn.
If I could, Madam Chair, make a suggestion. We have a couple of different findings. I have questions on the investment issue, but be nice, maybe we stick with the bus for a while. Drive that around, and then I'm not going to move to the other because everybody may have similar questions. But I had the same question Commissioner or Vice Chair Weintraub had, which is it seemed to me it's not the 15K and change, the 12K and change should be the number, right? Which is essentially I didn't understand it either. I appreciate you asking the question, and I understand that's how they reported it and that kind of thing. But that still seems to be more of a factual issue at this point, because they overpaid, and it's not as clear as the report makes it sound. A second issue on the bus is a similar theme as to what really can we say as a finding, and what really is a factual dispute. The report, as I read it, states that the Dodd Committee accepted a prohibited in-kind from the union, which is a rather serious issue. Because of the dollar amount, it may not be serious enough to go farther than the audit, but that's not really a reason not to worry about what the audit report says. There is some paper that makes it look like it came from the union, right? Invoice and whatnot. But we do have the committee, at least via proffer. There's no real way to sort of do testimony, and that's what audits don't do that. They take essentially representations by the committee that wasn't really an accurate invoice. It really was the pack. And then you also have the fact they think they paid the pack at the end of the day for the bus, right? They didn't pay the union, they paid the pack. Is that right?
That's correct.
Right. So at best, you have an issue of fact. But yet the audit report as written makes it sound like, as a matter of law, we're finding that they took a prohibited contribution. I can't vote for that as a finding. What I maybe could support is, if the bus really came from the union, then it's a prohibited contribution. But if the bus came from the union, the union PAC, then it's an excessive, I suppose. And that all presupposes that we agree that the commercially reasonable argument doesn't hold water. It is a long time. They do make an okay case as to why it took this long. But the auditors also push back with something that's somewhat persuasive, which is, gee, they had other things to pay. They didn't have a lot of money, but they didn't make this a priority, which isn't really fair to say because they don't really have to make it a priority. That's sort of a weird thing. But, you know, maybe it is, maybe it wasn't paid within commercially reasonable. But that still gets into a factual issue. I think there's a genuine issue of fact here. And it's tough in the audit context to say conclusively that they accepted a prohibited contribution when that's not what the facts say. Maybe they did. Maybe they didn't. It's still probably an issue. But I can't vote for the finding as written for that reason. And although the vice chair hasn't said where she is, the question she raised causes me to not be able to support the finding for the gist of those questions either. So that's my concerns on the bus. I'll give the auditors a chance to explain why they think that we can sort of, the commission can feel comfortable finding facts. I'm not sure what the answer will be because, well, the paper's trail speaks for itself, but I want to give you a chance to respond to what I said.
Well, my only response would be to continue what I've been saying. Based on the evidence provided to us, we determined that this was a prohibited contribution. Originally, it started at the full $32,000, but at the PAR stage, discussions and meetings determined that we would go forward with the $15,000 as a prohibited. I'm sorry, I said excessive, as a prohibited. So my only response is, based on the documentation we had, we made the determination that it appeared to be a prohibited contribution.
But it is true because you confirmed that they did pay the PAC, right? Now, that's a fact that undercuts your conclusion, right? It's inconsistent with...
It's inconsistent, but again, the invoice showed that it was the IAFF that incurred the rental portion.
And you had the committee saying that that invoice is incorrect. I'm not saying they're right.
Right.
I'm just saying they're saying it.
No, understood.
Right.
But that's what we relied on. And if I'm, and Ken can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe that may have been part of the rationale for not pursuing the wrapping, because I believe the PAC paid for that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. See, my point is you're weighing facts, and you're deciding that the invoice essentially trumps what the committee is saying and the fact that they paid the PAC. Because the invoice is from the union, but therefore it's a prohibited from the union. And what I'm saying is you can't make an audit finding when you have issues of fact. I think the audit report ought to reflect that there's a discrepancy on the facts. Maybe, you know, it would be a prohibited if, it would be an excessive if, but you can't really say that as a matter of law this is a prohibited contribution. It seems to me that there's a factual dispute. Now, maybe the commission feels comfortable finding facts. I'm not. You know, it seems to me that you could see this principle in cases beyond a bus, right? And something that seems like it's not going to come up all that often. Assuming hypothetically it's a case involving a lot of money, it results in a referral, right? And you know what's going to happen. It goes to a MER, and the position is going to be, well, the commission's already said these are the facts, and the poor respondent's never going to have a chance to say, well, wait, that's what about the fact that I don't think that's what happened? I've paid the wrong guy? It's just weird. So I throw that out to say that, you know, there should be a way to rewrite the report that I can support with respect to the bus, but I think it has to reflect the fact that there are two sides to the story here, and I don't think an audit is the place to decide which side is correct, given that it's not just hearsay, it's not just proffer, you actually have the payment, which is, to me, part of the paper trail. So even the paper trail is somewhat of a mixed bag. And I throw that out. Maybe others see the same issue But I think at this stage, we don't necessarily have to fly-spec it. I think the idea is there's another, you know, we get the finished product after this meeting. So, Mr. Bonowitz, you have some thoughts?
I'm sorry.
Ms. Painter has been trying to interject.
I don't know if this is what Alex was going to say, but the auditors asked the committee who paid for the rental of the bus, and the committee said it was the union. They didn't say it was the PAC. They said it was the union that paid the rental cost.
But they're saying now, but during the oral argument, which was quite some time ago, and that's another issue, which we'll discuss in a second, but... there's no question somebody thought it was from the union. Now, am I wrong that when council came here, I thought the representation at that time was that once the matter was reviewed, it actually was the PAC. And if the committee thinks it's the union and not the PAC, why would they pay the PAC? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think the committee has always represented that it was actually from FirePAC.
Right.
That's always been their position, but the documentation seemed to suggest something different from that. And also, actually, the check was to the IAFF FirePAC. So, I mean, you could say that's, I guess, to not necessarily to the union, but a lot of documentation that we had did support that it was the union instead of the PAC.
I'm not disagreeing. You have documentation that says it's from the union. No question about it. But you also have evidence that says it's from the PAC, and whether we're going to characterize this as a prohibited contribution or something else, I think is significant. Because if I were Chris Dodd, I would not want to find it says I took a prohibited contribution. If I had to pick my poison, I'd much rather have some excessive thing paid late or something a little bit fuzzier, because why do you want to say you took illegal money? If it's from the PAC, it's not necessarily illegal. It's just excessive. Like PACs could give the bus. Only give $5,000 worth of bus, I guess. But see what I'm saying? I mean, I understand. I'm not disputing the invoices say what they say. What I'm saying is you're finding facts that really I think the audit report ought to reflect that there are factual issues here and not just presume that what they did was the worst thing that could happen, prohibited, because they haven't shown you enough. It seems like the same variant with the document discussions we've had. Like, you know, you sort of presume that what they did was wrong unless they prove that they didn't do something wrong. And to me, they've at least created a genuine issue of material fact, to use sort of rules of civil procedure jargon. And that's my hang-up.
Mr. Bonowitz?
Yes, I just want to add that the position we're discussing is what the audit division took in the draft final audit report. In preparing the proposed audit report, the concerns of the commission would certainly be considered when we're preparing that, as well as how to word the issue.
Mr. Calvert?
Madam Chair, our colleagues in the audit division can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I thought I might try to spin out the story of who paid for what, as at least as I understand it. And it is a confusing story, and see if that's any help or not. I believe the report reflects this was actually originally a portion of this cost, the $16,000, I guess it was the wrap cost, was originally reported by FirePAC as an independent expenditure. And at some point, the Dodd Committee and the union discussed making the bus available to the Dodd Committee for its use. And they did that. And I thought I understood Mr. Smith to say that the committee had always maintained that this was from the union, but actually... I believe in the report, in the DFAR at page 10, it says, when questioned, Chris Dodd, for president representative, stated that the IAFF initially paid for the RV to use as transportation to events involving communications with the IAFF's restricted class. So what appears to have happened, and what was to some degree reflected in the invoice, is that the union paid for the bus, or for the RV, the union paid for the actual vehicle, and the PAC paid for the wrap. The auditors can perhaps help me out on this, but I'm not sure that the fire PAC ever reported that it paid any cost of the vehicle. Once they started once they determined that the Dodd Committee ought to pay for this, there was an invoice that stated a pro rata amount, but both, as Ms. Painter indicated, both fire PAC and the Dodd Committee continued to report this as a debt owed for the whole amount of both the wrap and the vehicle. The fact, and then at the end of the day, the invoice said, pay fire PAC. And the Dodd Committee did what the invoice told it to do. So this is sort of a confusing set of facts. But I think that at the outset of the audit, the auditors determined that while this was not the cleanest set of documentation you ever saw, that what it looked like was that the part that we're left talking about here, which is the actual vehicle and not the wrap, that the original disbursement for that had come out of fire PAC general treasury funds, or I'm sorry, out of IAFF general treasury funds, and there wasn't anything indicating that even though there was eventually a payment, whether or not the money eventually went back to the general treasury, that money was out there as having been expended by, for the vehicle, was out there as having been expended by the union, and was out there for the whole time that the Dodd Committee hadn't repaid this invoice. So if you were going to say that the use of the vehicle is a contribution because it wasn't reimbursed within either commercially reasonable time or 100.93, because we are talking here at this point not about the wrap and about we're talking only about the cost of the vehicle, the question then becomes, who paid for the vehicle? Who was out the money all of that time? That would seem to be who the contributor is. And the information, as we understand it, that the auditors had indicated that was not fire PAC, but it was the union.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there any evidence to that, going directly to that point, do we have any evidence beyond the invoice itself? Is there any paper trail? I mean, was there, for example, I mean, one thing that I thought of was, did at some point somebody, fire PAC or the union, somebody rented this bus, okay? They rented it from some vendor. There was a contract at some point in time with that vendor, and somebody was on the hook for that contract. Do we have the contract? Did we ever ask for the contract? Does it exist?
We asked that the committee, and I believe it was in the interim report, demonstrate who paid for it. We never got a copy of the contract or a check issued by IAFF showing that they actually paid for it.
Because it seems to me that would be the conclusive evidence of who paid for the bus. The invoice, which I happen to have in front of me, I happen to have it in front of me because we asked you for it and you gave it to us, so I appreciate that. The invoice is ambiguous partially for the reason that Mr. Calvert alluded to. It says, on the one hand, the Dodd campaign rented the bus from the IAFF for the period of December 17, 2007 through January 4th, 2008. But later on it says, payment can be made payable to IAFF Fire PAC. So it seems to me that the one piece of documentary evidence that we have is somewhat inconsistent It says on the one hand it's the union, and on the other hand it's the PAC. I'm not sure what conclusion is to be drawn from that. Moreover, it's actually not. It's even more confusing than a question of whether we're talking about $15,000 or $12,000, mm-hmm. because the $12,000 in the invoice, this says, this price was calculated on the total cost of the bus rental as well as the cost to wrap the bus. A previous decision of the commission took the cost to wrap the bus out of the calculation. So if we were to prorate, use the, you know, what they were trying to do, prorate the cost of the bus rental for the 18 days that the Dodd campaign had it, it wouldn't in fact be either $15,000 or $12,000. It would be, if my staff's math skills are better than mine, it would be $5,783.76. But, you know,
now you're talking.
Something under $6,000. Because it seems to me that if we took the wrap costs out, then the wrap costs are out. You know, we're not talking about the wrap costs anymore. We've already dealt with that at an early, the commission has, I actually, sad to say, missed that meeting. Judging by today, you'd think I never show up. But in fact, my attendance record is pretty good, but I happen to have missed that one where the commission made that decision. So I'm not the best person to opine on why the commission made that decision, but the commission apparently did make that decision unanimously, that the wrap costs were not going to be considered part of this in-kind contribution. So I think what we've got is, unfortunately, not the best possible evidence. You know, I suppose if we were in a different framework, if we were in enforcement, for example, and we could issue a subpoena, I suppose, and try and find the contract and figure out who really did make the contribution. But we're not in that world. We're here, and what we have in front of us is ambiguous, I think. Now, maybe this just reflects a misunderstanding on the part of the IAFF. Maybe they were just wrong when they said payment can be made payable to FirePAC, or maybe they had a good reason for saying payment can be made payable to FirePAC. I don't know the answer to that. The problem is none of us know the answer to that. But I think if we take out the wrap costs, what you know, it seems to me that regard, I mean, I, based on what counsel represented at the hearing, as best as I can recall it, it seems to me that what happened was they didn't pay this. You know, they had a bunch of bills, and you know, I agree with the committee that it was inappropriate to say that they didn't put a high priority on this. They just didn't have enough money to pay all their bills, and they paid some of them and didn't pay others. This happened to be in the not pay stack. When they had the money, they attempted to compensate for their earlier, the untimeliness of it, by overpaying, and I think they deserve some credit for that. They were trying to clearly sort of push this issue behind them, obviously unsuccessfully. But I don't think that is conclusive as a point of law. Obviously, the invoice is somewhat ambiguous, and we've already decided it's not conclusive as a point of law because the commission's already decided to take the wrap costs out, which are included in the invoice. So I think where I'm left is a bit of confusion as to whether it was from the firefighters or from the PAC, from FirePAC. And in any event, I think I just can't see any reason why we wouldn't prorate the dollar amount based on what they actually used.
Commissioner Walther?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think, given the amount of time that's elapsed and the amount of money that's involved in I was prepared to vote for the audit, but if there's enough feeling that we need to do something, maybe we could put a statement in there that there is a disputed or unclear what the facts are and move on, because I think, you know, the committee is entitled to some finality here.
Commissioner McGann?
The only point I want to add to what's been said by the vice chair is it's not like this is an audit of FirePAC. So to get the contract, I mean, it's beyond the scope of the audit, I mean, so it's not, I don't think, I wouldn't take from this that you're supposed to start asking for these contracts of committees that you're not auditing, right? So in a MER, you're right. If we wanted to reach out and have a non-party, but I wanted to make sure it wasn't taken as that somehow you were supposed to go and get this. But I do agree, it seems like it's just another way of saying the same thing. The facts can be read two or more ways. I hadn't really focused on that invoice. I'd assume that was in the camp of coming from the union. It turns out that's on both sides of the union. Is it from the union or the PAC? It cuts both ways. And I take from your comments that you agree that the report as written needs to at least reflect the fact that, you know, maybe it's from the union, but maybe it's not from the union, and that's a legal conclusion. The different legal conclusions flow from the facts, and it's tough to make a finding as to a legal conclusion when the facts could result in other legal conclusions. Okay.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find what the Vice Chair and Commissioner McGann, the concerns they've had, I find those persuasive. I think that if we could, in the proposed final audit report, include some language indicating that the evidence was somewhat inconclusive, and that I think Commissioner McGann even said, you know, on the one hand, if it was made by IAFF, it could have been considered a prohibited contribution. On the other hand, if it was FirePAC, who was the one who made the payment, then it would be considered an excessive contribution. Some sort of language that could take in, that reflected some of the conflicting nature of the evidence, I think would be appropriate. And I also think that the Vice Chair brings up a very good point about what the amount, the pro rata amount, should be in this case. I think it was $5,783 and change. I didn't get the change, but I think that would be a more accurate reflection. Well, it would be consistent with what the Commission has decided previously to have that be the amount. Otherwise, I think it would be, the other amount would be somewhat in conflict with other decisions the Commission's made up to this point in this audit.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, like Commissioner Walther, was prepared to support this particular finding. I think my reading of the facts, and apparently people can read them differently, is that this invoice came from the union itself, and you know, who they decide to pay to me is less determinative than who rented the vehicle at the outset and who issued the bill. Obviously, I think there's not support for that approach, but that's my view of it. I think that while this bus obviously had various occupants during a certain period of time, it was pretty clear, as I understood it, that it started out as something that the union rented for its own use, and then obviously because it was an attractive thing for the campaign to have, they made this arrangement. But I think the challenge here is, you know, that we have some rules about what's prohibited and what's the difference between who can give a contribution, who can't, makes the difference between excessive and prohibited. So that's my view. So I recognize where the votes are, but I agree with the original proposal from the audit division.
Any other questions or comments? Commissioner McGann.
If we're done driving around the bus, move to the next point. Before I get to, I just want to, you know, I'm risking sort of kicking a bee's nest on this, but we had the oral argument, what do we call it here?
Hearing.
The hearing, sorry. It's not argument. It's a presentation, supposedly. A long time ago, the directive that controls all this says we're supposed to get the report back within 30 days. It was like 2.5 months-ish before we got this. And I really look to the team leader to be the one to make sure these reports get done on time. Now, you maybe had other stuff to do. I don't know. But when the commission says 30 days, at least when I voted for it, I meant 30 days. That's not optional guidance. That's not try your best. And I think to move this along, these reports have to get done quicker, particularly when we had a very thorough hearing already, and fleshed a lot of this out. And, you know, the good news is that there's some of the time was probably well spent, which is why you have 30 days. Originally, I had wanted 10 days or 15 days. Others had said, no, they need more time. And 30 days seemed to, at the time, make some sense. Because you did hear what was said at the hearing and you did make adjustments to some of the findings and some of the language, which I think shows some progress. But on the other hand, when we say 30 days, I think we mean 30 days. And what's frustrating is we have the oral argument, and then I remember this, getting ready for this session was awkward because I felt like it was deja vu all over again. I thought, gee, and I read it, well, this is a problem. Yeah, and my staff would remind me, yeah, you asked that question, and the council said, oh, right. Yeah, and then it started to come back to me about this. So to the extent we can hustle it up after the respondent comes in and talks to us, I think the easier it is for everyone involved. And I don't read the directive as 30 days being 30 plus or minus, whenever it shows up. I think 30 means 30. If I could move to the finding, let's see. I guess it's a misstatement of financial activity finding. But that really concerns...
Commissioner McGann, if I might, I have one thing on the finding two.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I would just note that in the... I apologize for the interruption. I just thought it might be better to get all of finding two done.
Fine.
In the document before us, the ADRM... there are two other provisions in finding two. Obviously, Part A will need to be revised based on the views expressed at the table. But I did note that the conclusion to Part C, which is on the middle of page 4, explains in a little more detail about what the result of all of the subsequent activity was, including that certain amounts have been resolved and what remains unresolved. And I was hoping that, if my colleagues agreed, that we could add similar explanation to sort of wrap up the full explanation of what happened with respect to what happened in B, and my request was going to be on A, although that might obviously be overtaken by events. But to reflect what has been resolved in, although even if it's untimely, that what remains of anything, for example, the excessive contributions in Part B, to reflect what has actually been resolved by the committee, what remains unresolved, as we have in Part C, just to make that consistent.
Makes sense to me. Yeah, that I think that's a good suggestion.
And just one note on the timing. And I don't recall whether this was in this case. Sometimes we hold open the record for committees to provide a response to us after an audit hearing, and so that is one of the reasons that it might take longer to get a report. I don't know whether that happened in this case.
In this case, although the report required some extensive revisions, we were required to meet with counsel on some issues. We sent it down, the ADRM, for a legal analysis. In addition, we reached out to the committee, particularly with respect to the misstatement finding, to follow up on the filing of some amendments. And there's always other projects going on at the same time, but we try to do our best to get it done timely.
Sure, and I think the 30 days is an important deadline. I'm not suggesting that, but I do think that deadline also needs to accommodate the idea that if there's anything we need to be reaching out and discussing with the committee, I would personally rather have it take extra days to further that communication with the committee than just have a hard and fast mm-hmm. deadline. So, and obviously you did send this up to us in November, so we're just getting around to it now. But I think that we all have a concern about keeping these things moving, and unfortunately, the commission also has other things, and so this didn't get to an agenda until now, and so that's part of it as well. But my memory was also taxed on this. But with respect to finding two, I just think it'd be useful to make those conclusions consistent.
Understood.
Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. Look, certainly if the committee is if there's an ongoing process where the committee's providing additional information or there's an outstanding issue, I'm all ears. I think though, at 30 days, the commission ought to know that one way or another, right? Because it is still a deadline, and if there is sort of a I need more time, I think that should be something that's passed up the chain and not just taken into the hands of the field auditors to make that decision as on the fly. I think these folks need to know that, and that needs to get passed up the chain, because the 30 days is not, you know, the audit team has 30 days. It's 30 days for the whole operation to come around. So, you know, your first cut then has to be reviewed by your boss and then his boss, and then, well, actually, I don't want the gender pronouns, I just got it wrong, but your boss and then his boss and then her boss and then, right, so there's a lot of review. So it's not like you're the end of the train. You're the first step. You also did an interesting pivot and sort of shifted it over that direction. Now I know OGC has really improved dramatically on moving legal advice, and Mr. Holloway, I've complimented you before primarily, and you know, at Mr. Calvert's shop on this point. That it used to be stuff would take a long time. In this case, was there some sort of delay on this? I sort of have a timeline. It seems like this was ordinary course, and you sort of did a pretty good job with your legal scrub.
Could I speak? I didn't mean to imply that counsel
was
slow in what they were doing.
Okay.
I apologize if I did.
Okay. All right. Just wanted to make sure, because I took it that it was sort of a
no. I didn't mean to imply that.
Okay.
They were very prompt in their response.
Okay. Finding three, the misstatement. As I understand the facts, you have Senator Dodd, who is aspiring to be President Dodd. He raised some money for the general, which was invested in various investments, and he had an AO about how to shift some money around. Dodd has its kind of unique history. But long story short, the money that was invested lost some value. The stock, whatever the investments were never sold. There was a journal entry switching it over to the other Dodd committee, which I guess on the one hand is a separate entity, but really isn't. It's more of a legal fiction, because if you're the same candidate, for purposes of the Federal Election Campaign Act, you have common limits and whatnot. So I'm not so sure it's really a separate entity, which brings me to my point. The issue and the reason why they misstated the activity isn't because they didn't report the fact that they had this investment. It isn't because they didn't report the journal entry. It's the value. And it is being read as a reportable event. The journal entry is being equated with some sort of time where they should have reported a loss. I'm not sure I agree with that. I appreciate the legal analysis looking to the campaign guide and that there's different ways to do this, but I'm not sure it's a recognized loss at the time of the journal entry, because it seems to me to be a paper loss. I'm not sure it's a reportable incident. If you turn it around, if they had other investments that made money, sure, would you really think the IRS would buy this as a loss that they could offset for tax purposes? I'm not sure. I have no idea. But I see tax terminology here. I see the Christine Jennings MER. Remember that one where we had an issue where there were some tax issues there, and the commission, I think, correctly said that's not our expertise. I'm afraid that we're getting into terminology that, frankly, I don't know what it means, because I took income tax in law school and didn't do all that well. My father was disappointed. He was a treasury agent for years, but oh well. Can't win them all. So I don't see it really as a misstatement. Secondly, even if the commission were to decide, okay, when he made the journal entry, that really was the time of the loss and it had to be reported, I don't see how we can ding him now on a misstatement, which is essentially not getting the reporting details correct, when it is not at all clear that there is a way to do this that was easily ascertained at the time that the report was filed. The fact that there are multiple options, the fact that the council analysis concedes the point that it's really not clearly in the regs, we looked at the campaign guide and all that, I have trouble saying that there was a misstatement of financial activity. Now, that doesn't mean we can't use this as an opportunity to educate people and say, look, if this happens again and you report it this way or that way, we're not going to mess with you. Right? That's sort of what happened in the AFL-CIO audit 30 years ago. You know, you come up with a way, and if this happens, fine. But to me, it's not a realized loss in the journal entry. Now, maybe you've done some research on this, but I'm not sure it's even our bailiwick, because it seems to me, what if the investment came back and it was worth what it was when it was transferred? Now all of a sudden the second Dodd committee has a realized gain that they have to pay tax on? That doesn't make a lot of sense. I'm confused. Any help on this would maybe clear up my thinking. I understand that the instinct is that there's some event here that needs to be reported. I'm not sure.
I'll give it a shot.
Okay.
There's two distinct issues here. On page 16, with respect to the disbursements, we address the $351,000 transfer. Whether the you consider the book entry, when it was actually transferred, that it's really not an issue here. The issue with that transaction was our bank recs go through September 30th. The transaction actually took place outside the period, so we just want them to remove that from the report. So with respect to that transaction, there's, as far as the report's concerned, there's not an issue being addressed at this time with respect to a gain or a loss. It's merely a reporting error. They reported the $351,000 in September when the event actually took place subsequent to that, I believe October.
Mm-hmm. So the report makes it look like the journal entry was in September when it really happened in October?
That's correct. So it's just a reporting issue there. On page 16, above that, where we discuss the receipts, those net realized losses arise from the actual sale of bonds and stocks and so forth. They're realized losses.
When were those sold?
During the audit period. I don't have specific dates with me. It would have had to been between January and September of 2008.
But wouldn't that be the temporal key for the reporting then? I mean, that's not the time of the journal entry.
No. This is distinct from the 351. We're saying they should have reported these losses as well as reporting any gains, actual realized gains that occurred during the time period of the bank rec, 2008 through September.
Okay. I think I follow you. But am I wrong then in my characterization of how you're viewing the journal entry, that they somehow should have had a different dollar amount there and somehow that results in a significant misstatement?
That would be true if we did a bank recs subsequent to September 30th. Then that would be an issue addressed there, because...
All right. That would be true if...
We would have to do... Yeah.
Okay.
That would be true.
Am I right? Okay. But I don't know if. Am I right or wrong?
You're correct that would be an issue after September 30th.
Okay.
And that's why it's not addressed in here, other than please remove this from your reports filed prior to September 30th.
Okay. Let me ask it this way then.
Okay.
What's the material misstatement?
For as it stands now?
Yes.
Okay, I'll take disbursements first, including that $351,000 transfer, the misstatement would be considered material.
Right. We are talking about the journal entry transfer, right? $350,000.
In the context that it should have been removed from the report.
Right, but that's the predicate. That's the basis for your conclusion that
Correct.
There was a material misstatement. It flows from that. How you get there, that
contributed to the bulk of the misstatement.
Okay. So if I'm right, that when you shift it over because it wasn't sold at that time, mm-hmm. whether they reported it as the value that they purchased it, that's not. You have to say that the journal entry meant that somehow there was a realized loss at that point in time in order to have the report reflect that.
Right, but it would have been a report outside of this audit period.
Okay. Right. Well, that's good news for them.
For them?
Yeah, correct.
Right?
Good news.
I mean, if you take where I'm starting, that they'll flow that down the logic tree, that means they don't have a misstatement finding here.
If we need to consider this transaction here because it was reported in September of 2008. It was reported in the audit period.
Okay.
When it should have been reported in a report filed subsequent.
Right.
That wasn't part of the audit. If what I can say is...
Oh, so you're saying because they were a month off, they have a 300,000 plus material misstatement?
Correct. It may not, yeah. Yes, sir.
Huh. Okay.
Even, just to add on, even if this transaction did not exist, there still would have been a material misstatement of disbursements for this period.
Then I'm missing something. Why is there a legal analysis about what had to be reported value-wise? There's a disconnect in my mind here. Maybe counsel can help me.
We were addressing the realized losses that were that the auditors got from the broker statements. They were actual realized gains and losses that that were $150,370. That's up on the understatement of receipts.
Can I ask you about that? When you say they actually were realized gains and losses, you mean they sold the investment at that time?
These were actual...
I know it's on paper. But
these were actual sales according to the broker statements.
Okay.
That were the broker statements said were realized losses and were realized gains. And what the auditors did were they took both together to get the total of $150,000. So they took the gains and the losses and they netted it out. And so our analysis was concerning that. It was not about the transfer of the account, the entire investment account, or any loss value of that. We were only talking about these realized losses that were on the broker statements that we said should be reported. And the reason why they should be reported is because you should report your receipts, and the reason why you should report your receipts and disbursements is because if you don't, your cash on hand is going to be incorrect. Because one thing that RAD does is when they look at reports, they look to see if all the numbers add up. And if your cash on hand is different from the total of your receipts and disbursements that you reported, then RAD's going to notice that your reports are not going to be accurate. So they need to report their receipts and disbursements. And the campaign guides basically say that they should report a realized loss as a negative receipt.
See, I understand once we agree there's a realized loss and when that loss occurs, that's probably a reportable event, and then you've presented two different ways of, right, there's kind of the RAD way and the OGC way, to sort of, right, because it's not really clear in the regs, the campaign guide, and, you know, that's a different issue. But where am I getting this idea that the campaign is arguing that this is really just a journal entry? I mean, because didn't they report the 350 and carry it over, even though it really wasn't worth that much on paper at that time? I thought that was the issue.
Well, I think there was some confusion by the campaign just because there were issues earlier in the process of the audit about that transfer of value that are no longer in the report. So I think that created a lot of confusion. But this is a separate issue of these realized losses that were on the broker accounts. It has nothing to do with the transfer of the entire account.
Right. The concern I have is I think the report still muddles it together, and I'm having trouble differentiating. And I appreciate the discussion because it reading the report, it seems like it's still there, mm-hmm. And if it's not there, then I guess I made my point last time, right? But then now what's this? Now where are we now? Then they're 1 month off, so now they have a material misstatement.
Well, I think one of the things auditors are planning to do, as reflected in the ADRM, is that they were going to clarify this, and I think the draft proposed final audit report that they're working on is going to clarify. There were some references in there that caused confusion that are no longer going to be in the proposed final audit report.
So you're already ahead of me? The issues I'm raising, or it's not clear if we're already, the next draft is going to clarify this?
That's the plan.
That's the plan? Okay.
And Madam Chair, if I may, I was just going to add, there are really sort of two elements to the ministerial misstatement finding that still deal with this brokerage account. One is the 351. It's just a timing question. There in addition, there is a part of the material misstatement finding that does relate to what their broker told them were net realized gains and net realized losses. While we suggested reporting it one way, and RAD and the campaign guide suggest reporting it another, the problem is the committee didn't do either. The committee to this date has not reported any of those gains and losses.
I hear you. I hear you on that.
I just wanted to make sure that was clear.
Let's assume that they didn't report it correctly. The problem is I have trouble saying they didn't report it correctly, because there's not a clear way to report it, other than now that we've gone through this process and after the fact we have a legal analysis that gives them two options. If we want to say going forward, I'm not saying those are wrong options. I mean, if this were rulemaking, probably vote for them. If this were a standalone policy statement, great. But it's tough after the fact to ding a committee when it wasn't clear how to report it, right? Second, you have a response? Okay. That's all I have for now on that. So I guess this will get clarified.
I was just going to respond to your first point by saying that we totally understand your point that essentially the first time we worked this out in OGC, to my knowledge, with respect to realized gains, realized losses, was the Wiener audit, and those comments went public after the actual activity here. So I think we totally understand that point. On the other hand, it may not have been clear which would be the proper way, or that they're both proper to report it, it didn't strike us that it was a horribly huge leap to say, well, you got to report it in some fashion, simply because if we are dealing with what we all agree are gains and losses, you got to report it in some fashion, or else your cash on hand just it's not going to foot. It's either not going to be accurate or it's not going to add up at the bottom of the detailed summary page.
See, I'm with you on, okay, they should do amendments, and they haven't done amendments. But from their point of view, they probably don't want to amend until they know what the commission thinks they ought to do. Because, those who represent this committee have seen this one before, where a committee makes amendments to try to make nice with the auditors, and next thing you know, it ends up in Merland, and they say, well, gee, we just made the amendments because that's what we thought we were supposed to do to get rid of this thing, and now it's deemed an admission that somehow they've broken the law. So my guess is if we tell them how to do it, they'll make the amendments, the public record will be clear, the cash on hand will add up. But my gut tells me that they're not doing the amendments because they don't want it to come back and bite them and be stuck saying, well, you know, that train's left the station, you've already conceded, you messed up your reports. Could this case come up again? Maybe. I mean, at this point with the stock market, it'd be great if it came up again, a campaign actually, or in a way that they make money, or somebody's still putting money in the market using campaign funds. It's not the sort of thing that comes up for most campaigns. Certainly, you know, first-time candidates, rookie candidates don't have the luxury of having money, you know. And part of this is the fact that you raise general money before the general and you have to do something with it. And at the time, it made sense to try to let it grow. And then, well, that didn't work out so well. So it's not the sort of thing that's going to happen every day of the week. But I think we probably do need to offer some guidance in case this does come up again. And you know, I can't find anything wrong with the analysis. It seems fine. It's just I have a trouble applying it now and saying, you know, they misstated their financial activity when they didn't really have a clear path to do what we're suggesting now, and what they filed at the time seemed to be consistent with what was going on. So I don't know if there's a way to have it both ways, but that's kind of where I am.
Commissioner Walther?
Real quick, you said something about cash on hand wouldn't balance out, but if you have if you're in securities, you don't treat it as cash on hand, do you? Or you treat it something differently?
Commissioner, could you say again? I didn't quite understand.
You're really talking about securities. If there was a loss or a gain, it wouldn't affect your cash on hand. If they're unrealized.
If they're unrealized, but we're talking here about realized.
Yeah.
And if they're realized, that is going to affect your cash on hand.
Sure.
And we have said there's no requirement to adjust your disclosure reports based on unrealized gains and losses and fluctuations in fair market value.
Yeah. But then why do you pick a negative receipt? What was the thinking behind that? Is that still a preference or what? So we say one thing in the guidebook and then we say you can do either one, but maybe we ought to clarify it one way or the other.
The preference would be to do it the way the guidebook says. That's how audited always has always preferred it to be done. Had they reported it as a disbursement, I think we would have looked at that and considered that because the cash balance would still be correct.
Well, maybe we ought to make it clear then going forward.
Commissioner McGinn.
Just by way of context, early on in the audit, I think the position was this was maybe a contribution or somehow there was some issue on that front, or was this always, because this seems like this issue didn't really emerge until later, and it was, you know, until things got peeled off, this didn't really become clear. Is my memory somewhat correct on this?
I don't recall there being concern whether it was a contribution. The only issue we were looking at is the committee transferring out of its account all general contributions received. That was sort of the only issue we were looking at to ensure that they
were... That's it, right. It started out much more complicated than this,
yes.
Even though this is still not complicated but confusing. Okay.
Anything else? So you're all clear, ready for the next stage?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Good luck. You're going to circulate the PFAR next, right? No. What's the next stage of the process?
That's correct. Right.
Oh, that is correct.
Right.
Erica's shaking her head.
You need to.
Okay.
Don't take the vote on this.
Right.
The vote.
You have to vote on this.
You have to
vote.
So Commissioner Bowerly, just in case you didn't hear it, she said, so we should vote on the recommendation memo before us. I didn't realize that that was the plan, but...
I defer to Mr. Hintermeister as to whether they... I believe that
that's
as
correct.
Part of our normal process.
Right. Right, you would vote on the ADRM now, based on the discussion that we've had here today, and then make the changes and circulate a PFAR.
Okay. Is there a motion? Commissioner Peterson?
I'll make a stab at this. Hopefully, this will capture what needs to be captured. I move that we approve agenda document number 12-15 and instruct the audit division to write the proposed final audit report with respect to the audit regarding Chris Dodd for president, and that we further instruct them to make the necessary changes, not only reflected in the document itself, but also consistent with the discussion here at the table.
Thank you, Commissioner Peterson. Madam Vice Chair?
And I just want to clarify, so that would include modifying some of the findings, and because we started out with approving the document. It has certain findings in it, so the motion would have to include amending the findings to reflect the discussion at the table.
That is certainly my intention, so
I hope.
Thank you for that clarification.
Commissioner Walther?
What was the final discussion at the table regarding the bus that we were identify the fact that there were inconclusive facts on each side and therefore no formal finding or what?
And that the amount of the potential either excessive or prohibited was the 5,783 rather than the 15 or 12,000.
And I'll defer to the auditors to actually go back and check our math on that.
Okay. So the motion is on the table. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it, 6-0. Thank you very much. I'd like to take a minute to welcome Mr. Dan Patalis. He is our new Associate General Counsel for Enforcement. This is his first week. He started with us on Monday. He comes to us from the Public Integrity Section of the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice, where he served as a trial attorney for the past 8.5 years. Before working at Justice, he was a litigation associate at Vinson & Elkins. He attended law school at the University of Texas, served as a law clerk to the Honorable Thomas Rivoli in the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. He obtained his BA from California State University and has a master's in English from Texas A&M. We welcome you, Dan, and we're pleased that you're here. I'd like to thank Kathleen Guth, who served as acting associate general counsel for quite some time. We appreciate her stepping up to the plate and doing a fantastic job. She had there was a lot of transition in the division while she served in that capacity. She had a large docket to manage with a lot of very difficult issues arising from the 2010 election, and we appreciate your willingness to help us and for staying in the Office of General Counsel in this enforcement division. I know we'll benefit from your wise counsel and advice, so thank you very much. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I echo your comments of welcome and thanks to Dan and Kathleen. I also want to note that this is the last meeting at which I will have at my back, both figuratively and literally, Claire Rajan, who's been with the agency, I think, since 2005? 2005. Most of that time was spent in our litigation division, where her passionate and intelligent advocacy has been a real boon to the agency, as demonstrated, for example, by her recent victory in the RTAO case, which she argued for the FEC, also worked on the Adams case and the Gao case and a number of others where her input was invaluable. She's been, I kind of borrowed her, poached her from OGC, and she's been working in my shop as my EA and has done really everything, both substantively, the audits and enforcement and policymaking, worked on, like so many people, like coordination rulemaking, as well as helping to keep the agency running with her contributions on the Finance Committee. She is, as I've said, a passionate and skilled advocate. She's incredibly smart. She's a great writer, and I know she's going to be a great asset to the law firm that she's joining, and it's a deep loss to the agency and to me personally. But thank you, Claire, for everything that you've done for me and for us.
Thank you. Any other comments? Mr. Palmer, are there any management administrative matters to discuss?
Madam Chair, there are none.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.